Chapter 77. The little town of Great Winkleberry is exactly 42 miles and 3/4 from Hyde Park Corner. It has a long, straggling, quiet high street, with a great black and white clock at a small red town hall, halfway up a marketplace, a cage and assembly room, a church, a bridge, a chapel, a theater, a library, and in a pump and a post office. Tradition tells of a little Winkleberry, apostrophe down some crossroad about 2 miles off, and, as a square mass of dirty paper, supposed to have been originally intended for a letter, with certain tremulous characters inscribed thereon, in which a lively imagination might trace a remote resemblance to the word little, apostrophe was once stuck up to be owned in the sunny window of the Great Winkleberry Post Office, from which it only disappeared. When it fell to pieces with dust and extreme old age, there would appear to be some foundation for the legend. Common belief is inclined to bestow the name upon a little hole at the end of a muddy lane about a couple of miles long, colonized by one wheelwright, four paupers, and a beer shop. But, even this authority, slight as it is, must be regarded with extreme suspicion, inasmuch as the inhabitants of the hole aforesaid concur in opining that it never had any name at all, from the earliest ages down to the present day. The Winkleberry Arms, in the center of the high street, opposite the small building with the big clock, is the principal inn of Great Winkleberry, the commercial inn, posting house, and excise office, the blue house at every election, and the judge's house at every assizes. It is the headquarters of the Gentlemen's Whist Club of Winkleberry Blues, so called in opposition to the Gentlemen's Whist Club of Winkleberry Buffs, held at the other house, a little further down, : and whenever a juggler, or waxwork man, or concert giver, takes Great Winkleberry in his circuit, it is immediately placarded all over the town, that Mr. So-and-so, trusting to that liberal support which the inhabitants of Great Winkleberry have long been so liberal in bestowing, has at a great expense engaged the elegant and commodious assembly rooms attached to the Winkleberry Arms. Apostrophe, the house is a large one, with a red brick and stone front. A pretty spacious hall, ornamented with evergreen plants, terminates in a perspective view of the bar, and a glass case, in which are displayed a choice variety of delicacies ready for dressing, to catch the eye of a newcomer the moment he enters, and excite his appetite to the highest possible pitch. Opposite doors lead to the coffee and commercial rooms, and a great wide, rambling staircase, 3 stairs and a landing, 4 stairs, and another landing, 1 step and another landing, 6 stairs and another landing, and so on, conducts to galleries of bedrooms, and labyrinths of sitting rooms, denominated private, apostrophe, where you may enjoy yourself, as privately as you can in any place, where some bewildered being walks into your room every 5 minutes, by mistake, and then walks out again, to open all the doors along the gallery until he finds his own. Such is the Winkleberry Arms, at this day, and such was the Winkleberry Arms some time since, no matter, when 2 or 3 minutes before the arrival of the London stage. 4 horses with cloths on change for a coach were standing quietly at the corner of the yard, surrounded by a listless group of postboys in shiny hats and smock frocks, engaged in discussing the merits of the cattle. 6 ragged boys were standing a little apart, listening with evident interest to the conversation of these worthies, and a few loungers were collected round the horse trough, awaiting the arrival of the coach. The day was hot and sunny, the town in the zenith of its dullness, and with the exception of these few idlers, not a living creature was to be seen. Suddenly, the loud notes of a key bugle broke the monotonous stillness of the street. In came the coach, rattling over the uneven paving with a noise startling enough to stop even the large-faced clock itself. Down got the outsides. Up went the windows in all directions. Out came the waiters. Up started the hustlers, and the loungers, and the postboys, and the ragged boys, as if they were electrified, unstrapping, and unchaining, and unbuckling, and dragging willing horses out, and forcing reluctant horses in, and making a most exhilarating bustle. Lady inside, here. ' said the guard. Please to alight, ma'am, said the waiter. Private sitting room? Interrogated the lady. Certainly, ma'am, responded the chambermaid. Nothing but these ear trunks, ma'am? Inquired the guard. Nothing more, replied the lady. Up got the outsides again, and the guard, and the coachman. Off came the cloths, with a jerk. All right, was the cry, and away they went. The loungers lingered a minute or two in the road, watching the coach until it turned the corner, and then loitered away one by one. The street was clear again, and the town, by contrast, quieter than ever. Lady in number 25, screamed the landlady. Thomas, yes, ma'am. Letter just been left for the gentleman in number 19. Boots at the Lion left it. No answer. Letter for you, sir, said Thomas, depositing the letter on number 19's table. For me? Said number 19, turning from the window, out of which he had been surveying the scene just described. Yes, sir,
waiters always speak in hints, and never utter complete sentences.
Yes, sir, boots at the Lion, sir, bar, sir, missus said number 19, Sir Alexander Trott Esquire, sir? Your card at the bar, sir, I think, sir? My name is Trott, replied number 19, breaking the seal. You may go, waiter. The waiter pulled down the window blind, and then pulled it up again, for a regular waiter must do something, before he leaves the room. Adjusted the glasses on the sideboard, brushed a place that was not moldy, rubbed his hands very hard, walked stealthily to the door, and evaporated. There was, evidently, something in the contents of the letter, of a nature, if not wholly unexpected, certainly extremely disagreeable. Mr. Alexander Trott laid it down, and took it up again, and walked about the room on particular squares of the carpet, and even attempted, though unsuccessfully, to whistle an air. It wouldn't do. He threw himself into a chair, and read the following epistle aloud. Blue Lion and Stomach Warmer, Great Wingleberry. Wednesday morning. Sir. Immediately on discovering your intentions, I left our counting house, and followed you. I know the purport of your journey, that journey shall never be completed. I have no friend here, just now, on whose secrecy I can rely. This shall be no obstacle to my revenge. Neither shall Emily Brown be exposed to the mercenary solicitations of a scoundrel, odious in her eyes, and contemptible in everybody else's. Nor will I tamely submit to the clandestine attacks of a base umbrella maker. Sir, from Great Wingleberry Church, a footpath leads through four meadows to a retired spot known to the townspeople as Stiffen's Acre. Mr. Trott shuddered. I shall be waiting there alone, at 20 minutes before 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Should I be disappointed in seeing you there, I will do myself the pleasure of calling with a horsewhip. Horace Hunter. P.S. There is a gunsmith's in the High Street, and they won't sell gunpowder after dark, you understand me. P.P.S. You had better not order your breakfast in the morning until you have met me. It may be an unnecessary expense. Desperate-minded villain. I knew how it would be. Ejaculated the terrified Trott. I always told father that once start me on this expedition, and Hunter would pursue me like a wandering Jew. It's bad enough as it is, to marry with the old people's commands, and without the girl's consent, but
But what will Emily think of me, if I go down there breathless with running away from this infernal salamander? What shall I do? What can I do? If I go back to the city, I'm disgraced forever, lose the girl, and, what's more, lose the money too. Even if I did go on to the Browns by the coach, Hunter would be after me in a post chaise. And if I go to this place, this Stephens Acre, another shudder, I'm as good as dead. I've seen him hit the man at the Pall Mall shooting gallery, in the second buttonhole of the waistcoat, 5 times out of every 6, and when he didn't hit him there, he hit him in the head. Apostrophe with this consolatory reminiscence, Mr. Alexander Trotigan ejaculated, what shall I do? Apostrophe, long and weary were his reflections, as, burying his face in his hand, he sat, ruminating on the best course to be pursued. His mental direction post-pointed to London. He thought of the governor's anger, and the loss of the fortune which the paternal Brown had promised the paternal Trotter's daughter should contribute to the coffers of his son. Then the words to Brown's were legibly inscribed on the said direction post, but Horace Hunter's denunciation rung in his ears. Last of all it bore, in red letters, the words, to Stephens Acre, apostrophe, and then Mr. Alexander Trott decided on adopting a plan which he presently matured. First and foremost, he dispatched the underboots to the Blue Lion and Stomach Warmer, with a gentlemanly note to Mr. Horace Hunter, intimating that he thirsted for his destruction, and would do himself the pleasure of slaughtering him next morning, without fail. He then wrote another letter, and requested the attendance of the other boots, for they kept a pair. A modest knock at the room door was heard. Come in, apostrophe, said Mr. Trott. A man thrust in a red head with one eye in it, and being again desired to come in, apostrophe, brought in the body and the legs to which the head belonged, and a fur cap which belonged to the head. You are the upper boots, I think? Apostrophe, inquired Mr. Trott. Yes, I am the upper boots, apostrophe, replied a voice from inside a velveteen case, with mother-of-pearl buttons, that is, I'm the boots as belongs to the house. The other man's my man, as goes errands, and does odd jobs. Top boots and half boots, I calls us. Apostrophe, you're from London? Apostrophe, inquired Mr. Trott. Drive a cab once, apostrophe, was the laconic reply. Why don't you drive it now? Apostrophe, asked Mr. Trott. Over drive the cab, and drive over a human, apostrophe, replied the top boots, with brevity. Do you know the mayor's house? Apostrophe, inquired Mr. Trott. Rather, apostrophe, replied the boots, significantly, as if he had some good reason to remember it. Do you think you could manage to leave a letter there? Apostrophe, interrogated Trott. Shouldn't wonder, apostrophe, responded boots. But this letter, apostrophe, said Trott, holding a deformed note with a paralytic direction in one hand, and 5 shillings in the other, this letter is anonymous. Apostrophe, a what? Apostrophe, interrupted the boots. Anonymous, he's not to know who it comes from. Apostrophe, oh. I see, apostrophe, responded the Reglar, with a knowing wink, but without evincing the slightest disinclination. To undertake the charge, I see Biddo's thing, eh? Apostrophe, and his one eye wandered round the room, as if in quest of a dark lantern and phosphorus box. But, I say, apostrophe, he continued, recalling the eye from its search, and bringing it to bear on Mr. Trott. I say, he's a lawyer, our mayor, and insured in the county. If you've a spite agen him, you'd better not burn his house down, blessed, if I don't think it would be the greatest favor you could do him. Apostrophe, and he chuckled inwardly. If Mr. Alexander Trott had been in any other situation, his first act would have been to kick the man downstairs by deputy, or, in other words, to ring the bell, and desire the landlord to take his boots off. He contented himself, however, with doubling the fee and explaining that the letter merely related to a breach of the peace. The top boots retired, solemnly pledged to secrecy, and Mr. Alexander Trout sat down to a fried sole, mainten and cutlet, Madeira, and sundries, with greater composure than he had experienced since the receipt of Horace Hunter's letter of defiance. The lady who alighted from the London coach had no sooner been installed in number 25, and made some alteration in her travelling dress, than she indited a note to Joseph Overton, Esquire, Solicitor, and Mayor of Great Winglebury, requesting his immediate attendance on private business of paramount importance, a summons which that worthy functionary lost no time in obeying, for after sundry openings of his eyes, divers ejaculations of bless me, ... and other manifestations of surprise, he took his broad-brimmed hat from its accustomed peg in his little front office, and walked briskly down the high street to the Winglebury Arms, through the hall, and up the staircase of which establishment he was ushered by the landlady, and a crowd of officious waiters, to the door of number 25. "Show the gentleman in," said the stranger lady, in reply to the foremost waiter's announcement. The gentleman was shown in accordingly. The lady rose from the sofa, the mayor advanced a step from the door, and there they both paused, for a minute or two, looking at one another, as if by mutual consent. The mayor saw before him a buxom, richly dressed female of about 40. The lady looked upon a sleek man, about 10 years older, in drab shorts and continuations, black coat, neckcloth, and gloves. "Miss Julia Manners," exclaimed the mayor at length, "you astonish me." "That's very unfair of you, Overton," replied Miss Julia, "for I have known you long enough not to be surprised at anything you do, and you might extend equal courtesy to me." "But to run away, actually run away with a young man," remonstrated the mayor. "You wouldn't have me actually run away with an old one, I presume?" was the cool rejoinder. "And then to ask me of all people in the world, a man of my age, and appearance mayor of the town, to promote such a scheme?" Pettishly ejaculated Joseph Overton, throwing himself into an armchair, and producing Miss Julia's letter from his pocket, as if to corroborate the assertion that he had been asked. "Now, Overton," replied the lady, "I want your assistance in this matter, and I must have it. In the lifetime of that poor old dear, Mr. Cornberry, who was to have married you, and didn't, because he died first, and who left you his property unencumbered with the addition of himself," suggested the mayor. "Well," replied Miss Julia, reddening slightly, "in the lifetime of the poor old dear, the property had the encumbrance of your management, and all I will say of that is that I only wonder at Gutenberg edition." End of chapter.